Umberto Eco, an Italian scholar and author of best-selling novels, notably The Name of the Rose, died on Friday at his home in Milan, Italy. He was 84. As a practitioner of semiotics, one who studies signs and symbols and how they are used, Eco sought to interpret cultures, and his scholarly studies were infused into his fiction writing. Umberto Eco joined us on the Book Show in 2012 to discuss his then most recent novel, The Prague Cemetery, a work that was denounced by the Vatican. We air a portion of that conversation in memoriam this morning.
As a scholar, I have always been interested, and also as a professor, to problems of languages. I mean, not only verbal language, but all the languages. And one of the characteristics of human languages is the possibility of lying. Because when a dog barks, it tells the truth. There is somebody down there.
Right.
But a dog is unable to bark in order that there is somebody and somebody is not there. So a dog cannot lie. Human can lie. So it's an important feature of human mind and language. Starting the problem of telling the contrary of the truth, I met the problem of forgeries in general. And I have written a lot during my, in the last, 30, 40 years, about all the different kinds of forgery from a linguistic point of view. And by in studying the forgeries, obviously the most radical, the most important, the most tragic among the forgeries that have shaped our history is the Protocols of the Elders of Science. And I was mentioning them in my second novel, Foucault's Pendulum. I wrote several essays on the concoction of this forgery, because also I believe to have found two additional sources in the dime novels of the 19th century. And I was more and more interested in the protocols for two reasons. One is that they are a highly self-contradictory text. In fact, it was composed as the Frankenstein monster with parts of different human corpses. And you see it, you see that it has been a sort of collage of different sources, so nobody could take them seriously, but it was taken seriously. Now is sold in every newsstand in the Arab countries, studying in their school, but even in the Western world you can. Give me the yellow pages, I find you two or three bookstores in which you are so sure you can find the protocols. The other reason is that in 1921, the London Times proved that they were a forgery, very clearly finding its sources. From that point on, it was more and more believed and taken seriously. So we are facing monstrous phenomenon, and I was interested in telling the story of how a forger can step by step build up such an object. Obviously, the protocols were the effect of a collaboration of many hands, while in my novel, for narrative reasons, I had to invent a unique character, Simonini, who is the author of all this. But this is the only invention, I would say, of my book. Everything is historical truth.
In a letter to readers, you say, I'm expecting two kinds of readers. The first has no idea that all these things really happened, knows nothing about 19th century literature, and might even have taken Dan Brown seriously.
Yes, certainly I can expect two kinds of readers. That's why I introduced the illustrations. Mine is an illustrated novel, which is not so strange, because every 19th century novel, especially the popular ones, but even the great classics, were illustrated. And I used illustrations taken from books of that era. But the illustrations have a double function. Some of them are clearly picked up from novels, and so give my reader the impression that I am telling a fantastic story on the 19th century. But suddenly, some illustrations are historical documents. Certain pages of anti-Semitic journals, some portraits of real people, and so on and so forth, so that my reader should feel a sort of shock. I believe it was a fictional story. Now I realize it really happened. And so my reader is oscillating between those two poles.
And to help things along, you have included a main character who it seems that you deliberately made the most cynical and disagreeable in all the history of literature.
I hope you hate him.
Yes.
Yes. Initially, there was, let me say, a sort of moral reason. This character is touching with his hands such trashy material, disgusting material that I wanted the reader was able to keep a distance from him. And so I was obliged to make him repugnant. Step by step, as a narrator, I was taken by the pleasure of constructing such a disgusting character to such an extent that when my wife read the book, only at the end when it was finished, because when writing a book, I go on for 6 or 8 years without informing anybody what I'm doing. When my wife read the book, said, "Oh, now I understand why in the last 2 years you were so bad."
So you do internalize.
So I was becoming, step by step, I was becoming like my character, it seems. Or my wife has a lot of humor.
You make the point that all of the characters except for Simone were real people.
Yes. You know, there was an old captain, Simonini, who was an historical figure, who wrote a famous letter in which he wanted to demonstrate that at the origin of all the conspiracy, there were the Jews. Okay. Nobody knows exactly who was that Captain Simonini. Only the letter is known and circulated a lot during the 19th century. So maybe he, too, is the effect of a forgery. But in any case, the history records the presence of that mysterious Captain Simonini. So my Simonini is the grandchild of this Captain Simonini and receives from him all the racist beliefs. The book starts with a list of declaration against different people. It is not only anti-Jews, anti-Germans, anti-Italians, anti-French, anti-women, anti-everybody. In this sense, my Simonini is a fictional invention, while all the other characters are true. Even characters that some of my readers believed I invented them because they believed it was impossible that they really existed. There is a certain Leo Taxil, who is an incredible character, but he really existed and did what he does in my novel. But I think that in another way, Simonini is truer than the other character. I have the conviction that there are many Simoninis around us. I could point my finger and tell you, this is a Simonini of our time.
I saw you speak once, and I heard you say that the real challenge for you is to make the writing process last as long as possible, delaying that moment of the end.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a way of delaying continually the end until the moment, and this is another mystery of writing or of fiction, the book says, "I am finished," and you have to obey it. The book says, "Stop, don't add anything else," and you have to stop. Otherwise, one could continue. And in fact, I believe that book would have been finished in 213 or 14, and that at a certain point, I realized that I had to stop. So the research is fascinating. It's not by chance that in describing the 19th century Paris, even though I know Paris very well, but I recovered a lot of old guides and books about the restaurants, about the pubs, about the old streets where they were selling this or that. So I tried really to live in that milieu. Another anecdote regarding my wife. we went to Paris, and I wanted to visit the streets where Simonini lived. And at a certain point, my wife saw three steps and the door, and he said, did Simonini pass through there? I said, but he didn't exist, so he couldn't pass through there. But my details were so precise that at a certain moment, for a reader, it was difficult to distinguish between reality and fiction.
I would assume that that is something that you want of your reader to have that sweat on the brow and the concern of the things
yes,
that
yes.
go bump.
No, certainly.
I mean, and that's what you're doing. I mean, you want us to believe that he is among us.
Oh, yes. I would like my readers would understand that I was not only telling a past story, but I was alluding to contemporary history. It's enough to see what happened with the WikiLeaks to understand that there are many Simoninis around.
When you look at your work, and the book is out, and it's really a 2-year process for you, isn't it? Of once it's done and it's published, of you sort of seeing it through around the world before you move on to the next thing.
Yes. I have always said that to write a novel, more than a linguistic business, is a cosmological affair. You have to build up a world, a complete world, even though you don't speak entirely of it, but you have to set up this world. And language will follow, while in poetry it's exactly the opposite. You must have a language and the possible world will follow. But with a story, you have to feel confident with the world that you build up step by step. That's why, for instance, before writing The Name of the Rose, I spent at least 2 years studying all the possible plans of a library, of an abbey, or designing labyrinths, and so on and so forth. And this is the most enjoying aspect for me, the most enjoying aspect of writing a story. I can guess that for other writers, things may go differently, in the same way in which there are writers that write a novel every year. For me, it would be unthinkable to go so fast. I would lose the 80% of the pleasure of writing.
You spoke a moment ago of Name of the Rose, and is that something that you're greatly proud of the success of that novel?
In a way, I should say that I am irritated by, for these simple reasons, that I give you a scientific example. Every time I publish a new novel, the selling of The Name of the Rose grows up. So readers say, oh, there is a new novel of Eco, but I have not read the first one. So they go to buy the old one and not the new one. So I am in a certain sense blackmailed by the success of the first book. I could say that probably some of the following of my novels are better than The Name of the Rose, but The Name of the Rose is the... But I think it's the same that happened to other writers, let's say Gabriel Garcia Marquez. After 100 years of solitude, he could have written a lot of marvelous books, but people goes always back to 100 years of solitude. Okay, you have to accept that. Obviously, I am very pleased that that book, after 30 years, still have devotees and young readers and survives. Okay, an author cannot be but happy of that.
The late Umberto Eco on The Book Show in 2012. The full interview is available online at wamc.org. The scholar and author died on Friday at his home in Milan. He was 84. And of course, we also note we lost another literary giant on Friday, Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird and currently on the New York Times bestsellers list with Go Set a Watchman, died Friday at the age of 89. She was laid to rest in Monroeville, Alabama, in a small private service on Saturday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.